Item seven, or I'm sorry, item six, education presentation on asset allocation.
Stretch this out to make it worth your while to showing up today.
No, Gabe's got somewhere to be, so we're turning through it.
Fair enough. Forgive my voice. I'm getting over the third cold of the season. Kids bring so much into your lives, mostly germs.
Did you get the sore throat with it?
No, not yet. I'll let you know. So hopefully I can get through this with my voice going out. You recall at the November offsite, we had a long conversation about what success looks like under the FFP structure, what we expect each sub-portfolio to deliver. And I think the feedback from a number of trustees was, that's good information, but there's a higher level conversation needs to happen of how should we expect the total fund to behave. So if everything's moving along on the sub-portfolio level, what should we really expect the total fund to do? And it's that top level performance conversation that we're going to have today. And I want to try and get this into an easy to understand, easy to remember, kind of narrative here that's going to give you the talking points you need to understand the context of our performance here. And really, starting to step through this fairly quickly here. So slide two, and I'm not going to project this up here because it's a fairly brief presentation. I want this to be a conversation more than a presentation. The FFP structure really is this idea of tying out different portions of the portfolio to different functions, to the benefit payments, to the growth for future benefit payments, and the ability to weather. And I think all the trustees kind of took away from November, we get that. And we get that there's a technical explanation about how each sub-portfolio is running and whether it's running effectively. But what I want the trustees to walk out of the room here today understanding and remembering is, one, a reminder of what FFP is, but two, I want you to have an understanding of the shape of the returns, of the pattern of returns that we expect with FFP, as opposed to a more traditional structure, and that's what we're going to get into today. So really the hallmark of the FFP structure is this dedicated liquidity program that, without depending on trading, every month is designed to throw off of benefit payments through maturities and contractual income that matches what we expect from the actuary, what we expect our benefit payments to be. So the actuary can project out. It's one of our great advantages is we have a high degree of certainty about how much we're going to have to pay every month for years to come. So the actuary projects out, and then we set up a portfolio that will generate through maturities and contractual income every month approximately that same dollar amount. That way we're not, if the market locks up like it did in 2008, where suddenly we have difficulty trading bonds, we're not dependent upon that trading pattern. If the pricing gets a little bit sideways on some of these bonds, well, okay, we're not trading them nonstop. We're generally holding them to maturity, so we're somewhat insulated from that. And when we become insulated from that bond market volatility, it allows us to take additional risk where we're compensated for it in the growth portfolio, largely in the private markets. So really, it's the tailored approach allows us to take risks where they're most fruitful for Sicera, and the aggregate is going to lead to, we expect, a smoother return pattern versus a more traditional asset allocation. And sort of the takeaway here really is you should expect the total fund to rise less than peers in a rising equity market, fall less than peers in a falling equity market, have a smoother overall pattern. And I think the phrase we throw around internally is we win by not losing. If we don't have the big drawdowns, we don't have to have the big gains. But we have a period like this fourth quarter where the equity markets are up very strongly. We should expect to be up but less than some peers, and we'll make it up when the equity market has a pullback. So slide three really just goes through that visual representation of what each one of the three buckets does for us. Liquidity, store, disperse. We don't depend on that for a lot of growth, very little growth in there with today's yield environment. Growth really is, we want this to be our compounding category where we want to be able to put money there, have it sit for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, compound, and we harvest gains in the future. And risk diversifying, which is the next conversation we're going to be having with the trustees over the coming quarter, is our ability to rebalance, our ability to weather an equity market drawdown and have money available to rebalance into cheap stocks, essentially. But it's the, yes.
But rebalance.
Yeah.
Define rebalance in this.
Sure.
Where are we taking it from and where are we putting it?
So the blue bucket liquidity is largely we set that gets drawn down. You know, we set it with 4 years of benefit payments,
right.
Gets drawn down, and every year we refresh it. That's pretty mechanical. Every year it gets refreshed with the next fourth year of benefit payments. So that one, we don't rebalance on an annual basis. We refresh on an annual basis. And we refresh according to the next actuarial projection. So that one's really sized in dollars. The actuary comes back to us and says, we project out, you know, $400 million in benefit payments this year, $450 next year, $500, $550, and we set up the portfolio to meet those dollar amounts. The growth and diversifying is the remainder. So the growth portfolio is really most akin to what we've done historically. What we've done historically is largely have a risk-efficient growth allocation. Heavy into stocks, heavy into real estate. It just set up to, you know, be that compounding engine. The liquidity is there because we're now, you know, tipping to having the cash flow negative. Our benefit payments exceed our contributions, so now we have to generate the excess there. So the rebalancing, Jerry, to your point here, the growth would include our public equity exposure, which is largely the most volatile asset we have in the lineup here. Shockingly enough, 2008 was almost 10 years ago now. It's very fresh in my memory. It's probably fresh in most of your memories. It'll be fresh in my memory until the day I leave this industry and probably until the day I leave this earth. But the idea there is really when we have an equity market drawdown. So when the stock market's down 10, 15, 20%, because we have a lot more illiquid in the growth allocation, we need a different bucket to be able to draw from to come back in and buy up stocks to be our target allocation again. And that's the risk diversifying. And we have a placeholder there now. We'll be back in front of the board in February talking about the build out of that risk diversifying allocation.
When you look at the stock market, the public equities though, are you measuring from the point you bought it at? In other words, let's say you bought it at this point, we've known it's gone up a lot, and it gets back to that one point.
Sure. So we have target allocations and ranges for every asset class here. We're constantly doing trims and adds. That's the mechanical portion of this. That's the, you know, in a normal market environment, the equity market's up like it was last year. We're trimming. We're trimming and funding other things here. But what the risk diversifying allocation is really when there's a big equity market drawdown. Because we have such a relatively large illiquid allocation within the growth assets, it's like roughly half. When we're at target with our private equity, our private credit, and our private real estate, we're not necessarily going to have other assets available in the growth category to come back into the stock market. We want to have that in the risk diversifying. So something that behaves differently in the stock market, generally we expect it to hold up or actually be positive when the stock market's down significantly. Draw that down, come back in, and come back up to target in the stock market. So that's really the functionality there. And because we have those two categories off to the side, the liquidity, the ability to meet benefit payments, is insulated. The board can choose to resize the liquidity allocation. You know, you can choose to reallocate some of that elsewhere, but that's a board decision. Mechanically, from a staff perspective, we're moving between that growth and risk diversifying back to targets generally.
To me, what this really boils down to is whether we can continue to stay at 7% discount rate. We are taking 25% of our portfolio and insulating it at 2%, give or take. So that 5% differential on a quarter of the portfolio has to be made up by the other 75%. At 7%, are we still in a real, in a defensible world? And of course, I'm assuming you're going to give us the answer by the end of your presentation.
It's a wonderful segue to the next page. Point taken, I'll speed it up here. Let's actually go over to slides 4 and 5 here, and I think this will address your point there. The expectation is that by having this insulated portion, yes, there's an opportunity cost associated with having a dedicated liquidity profile. But what it allows us to do is take advantage of some things that are illiquid. Now, we don't go into illiquid or private markets just because they're private markets. We go into them because they have a higher expected return. And so we take our risk in the private markets generally in today's environment. Every year, Verisk comes in and gives you updated capital market assumptions, runs an analysis, and we'll say, you know, we expect over the next decade this asset mix to return 6.5, 7, 7.5, et cetera. And I think if you'll recall back to when we adopted all of this 2.5 years ago, we looked at a number of different allocations. They all got us roughly to the same endpoint. This one followed a different path. This one followed a smoother path. And I think that was part of the attractiveness here, was it allowed us to take the illiquid risks that we expect to be compensated for. So it allows us to overcome the opportunity cost of a quarter of the portfolio in 2% yield. But we generally with a, you know, a lower volatility profile. And we weren't necessarily as worried about the illiquid portion of that because we had this dedicated benefit payment portfolio. We could afford to take this illiquidity risk over there. And if you take a look at slide four, I think really the takeaway here, and this is probably one of the key slides, the FFP concentrates the range of expected outcomes over a narrower path. It's still right around the 7% number. And you'll be back in March, Ed, with updated capital market assumptions? Yep. And we'll take another look at it then. But what we can see here is you've got, you know, in black line there is a normal distribution. In the yellow, it would be a traditional, I think in this case, a 60-40 asset allocation, a traditional asset allocation. And you can see that's shifted positive. You expect to do better than a normal distribution because of the effects of diversification and some of the illiquid asset classes. But really what Cicera does is really kind of narrow that right around the midpoint. So what do we, you know, what's the cost of narrowing the range of distributions? Well, we give up the left-hand side and we give up the right-hand side. Again, we don't suffer the big drawdown, so we give up, you know, on the left-hand side, we don't have as many incidences of the down 20, 25, 30%, which are very difficult and potentially damaging to a pension fund. But, you know, consequently, we don't have as many of the up 20, 25, 30% years. So we tend to focus more around that midpoint distribution there. So we still get to something like a 7%, and that will change from year to year based upon, you know, what the market does and how much growth we think is still left in the market, and we'll have that conversation. So, you know, will it be 7% next time? I don't know the answer to that. It'll be in that range, but it'll be equivalent to what a 60-40 or 70-30 allocation would be, generally speaking. And if you take a look at the capital allocation on slide five, I mean, this is really why, if you take a look at that purple category, 28% in private equity and private credit is really large relative to where we were. And I think when you talk to your peers at CalPERS or SACRS, it's probably large relative to most of your peers. And the reason we're doing that is we expect to get compensated for the risk we're taking here above and beyond what we could get in a simpler growth allocation. So above and beyond what we get from the S&P 500, above and beyond what we can get from U.S. small cap stocks. We take that risk because we expect to be compensated for it. We expect that to be our growth engine over a long period of time. So, and this is the reason why we hired StepStone and have that private credit portfolio up and, you know, running now. Why the, you know, we're maintaining our private equity exposure. Take a look at that global equity allocation, the blue there. It's why we've tilted in the direction of emerging markets away from U.S. equity. We expect to get paid there, and now we can accept some of the volatility, some of the uncertainty associated with that because our liquidity is handled elsewhere in the portfolio. So because we have the liquidity, we can take this risk. What does that mean? Well, we think we've come up with a smoother path that still has risky assets embedded into it. Any questions? Everybody with me? So far, you let me know. All right.
I wanted to go back to John's question, if I could. The assumed rate of return at 7% or whatever number it were is a long-term number, right? That's not a, we're going to look at it every 6 months or every 12 months, right?
Yeah.
So I guess I wanted to sort of re-ask John's question.
Okay.
In terms of the long view. Does the structure, I think I know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do we think the structure of the FFP portfolio over time would achieve the result that we've assumed?
Let me reframe the question the way I think about it, and I'm not trying to not answer your question, I just think about it a little bit differently. The asset allocation is, you know, it's an allocation of risks and functions. What's available in the marketplace, where do we want to be exposed to in order to get to that long-term growth rate? Then the actuary is going to come in and say, like, well, I think that's it, you know, 7.2 or 6.7 or et cetera there. So when we did this initially, we took a look at a lot of different portfolio construction methodologies. What we found was everything from a 60-40 to a 70-30 to more of a risk-focused allocation to the FFB, they all got to, over a decade, the expectation was they're in a pretty narrow range of expected returns. And they're all relatively close to the actuarial rate. So there was a lot of different paths to get to the same outcome there. What we found was this had a lower expected volatility, so lower year-to-year variation with FFP. And the risk-focused allocations also had a lower year-to-year variation. So it still gets you to the same endpoint, but just with less, you know, tracking error from year-to-year around the actuarial discount rate. The reason I answered it that way is I don't like to necessarily have the actuarial discount rate drive asset allocation. I want the asset allocation, it really should be an independent decision of the board. Where do we want to expose the portfolio? Where do we want the risks? Well, what risks do we want in our portfolio? Then have an independent arbiter come in, and the actuary in this case, and give you a view of, well, I think it's going to cost you X, Y, Z to get there, and set the actuarial discount rate accordingly. Okay. So. I'm just a little sensitive about that.
So, well, but I think, yes, this is designed to accomplish our objective.
I guess I was speaking less about trying to make the portfolio match the assumed rate of return.
Yeah.
I'm more concerned about whether, just all things being equal and knowing what we know, are we in the right place with our assumed rate of return? If not, I think we'd all be willing to at least have the conversation about whether it's right or whether we're kidding ourselves or overindulgent, not being optimistic enough, whatever it is. But I just want to be sure that it's really the assumed rate of return discussion is reflective of what we're doing. And we don't have a disconnect.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting the portfolio should do that. I'm suggesting that discussion should match what our portfolio decision was.
Yeah, and so two answers there would be the FFP structure on an expected basis is not dissimilar from other structures. Your question would be, where are all those structures kind of expected to be over the next decade, and is that 7%? Well, that's where we want to have the updated capital market assumptions. I will, you know, Ed, without giving anything away, capital market assumptions heading up or down relative to last year?
Oh, down.
We had a good year, so we brought a lot of that growth forward. We should expect lower. So, you know, the conversation will be probably trending in a lower direction. We'll see what that is in March. But the conversation is going to trend in a lower direction regardless of your particular asset mix. The growth assets simply aren't going to return as much over the next decade on an expected basis.
Tim, there's been a fair amount of publicity on PERS having a 10-year projection at 1.5 or 2.5, anybody else who's seen it, but it's gotten lots of publicity. And so, at least one of the more recent articles on this, PERS apparently is doing is assuming 6.25 for 10 years and then 7 or 7.5 or whatever their point in between is from that point forward. In other words, there's a gorilla in the room, just in terms of size, that has come up with a fairly high-profile number, less than our 7%. And ultimately, what you're describing is absolutely reasonable. We need to pick the way in which we're going to invest and project the results of our portfolio. And then the second role of the board is to determine when that moment comes, whether or not the assumption we're using is a reasonable fit with that.
John, where did you read that? Because I want to go to it and read it. I haven't read it.
There are a bunch.
There's a few different publications.
I'll bet if you put it in Google, PERS projection, PERS actuarial returns assumption or asset return assumption.
And it's 6.6 point. They said 6.35 or something.
No, I'm. It's either it was 6.15 or 6.25. But with apologies for my.
The last I heard, BERS was 7%.
Well, that's right. They dropped on a projected basis. They aren't at 7 now. They're at something closer to 7.5, but they're aiming towards 7.
Doing a step.
It's a step down.
Over how long did the article say how long?
The article say how long
before it gets down to 6.35?
1.5. Well, those are two different things. It was how long they get from 7.5 to 7 as an assumption, and then the second part was what their investment specialists, experts say they really expect to earn in the next 10 years, and it's the 6.15 or 2.5 that they expect to earn in the next 10 years. Okay, so they clearly have a mismatch between the two, and that was an important part of the article.
I think okay. Dan Bornstein also wrote a column in the last month that referenced this disparity.
I think he did.
Yeah. I read that one. Yeah. But that was saying going from 7.5 down to the 7, what you're talking about. I didn't see the part where it said they expect to earn 6.25 after that.
I think it's down to 7. I think it's 3 years or something.
That might
like that.
Be
yeah,
it's 3 years.
It's 3 or 5.
It wasn't immediate. It was right. Phased down. Yeah.
Jerry, right. I can send you something on that, too.
Can I add a couple points to the discussion? So on the assumed 7% or any plan's assumed rate is the combination of an inflation factor and the return, the real return. And so an important point here is that Verisk uses an assumed inflation rate in building the asset allocation model and coming up to what an expected 10-year return will be. That is almost always different than what the actuarial expectation for inflation is, the primary driver being different time frames. We look at 10 years, actuaries tend to look at 30 years. And so it's important to adjust for that and think about it in real return basis. That way you have an apples to apples comparison.
Yeah.
And that helps close the difference typically.
Yeah.
So that's point one. Point two is that with any assumed rate of return, we also give you a standard deviation or volatility around that number. And we talked about the volatility concept in November and how different volatilities can play out. And just by design of a program of saying a 7% return with a 12% volatility, over 10 years, that can naturally lead to good and bad outcomes that can basically be justified as luck. It's what the market gives us. It's not by design, it's what the market gives us. And so when you factor in volatility and you say 12% volatility, this past year is a really interesting case because if you expect a 7% return and you have a one standard deviation of 12%, that means you could go 7 plus or minus 12. So 19 to minus 5 is all within the range of normal, statistically speaking. So we have this year, we didn't hit 19%. So this year, which is basically viewed as a really strong year for the equity markets, is normal. So just kind of prepare yourself because a minus 5% year is also normal, and that would hurt a lot more. So I think what Tim's talking about here is trying to design a plan.
Isn't that the purpose of functionally focused?
Yeah,
to keep it somewhat level.
We're supposed to, so there's some sanity
in what we do.
We're
limiting that volatility.
We are limiting it. We are not eliminating it.
No, I understand. No. You can never eliminate it. But we certainly are limiting it because otherwise we'd be all in on the equity market and just loving the last 13 months and then waiting for it to crash down.
Half dome.
Yeah. Right. So to the extent you can bring that 12% volatility down to 11 or 10, it's really meaningful. That's really impactful. So.
Well, we could eliminate it. We could buy all U.S. Treasuries.
You would take your 7% away then.
No question.
Pretty much.
Yeah, we would.
No, that was in jest, obviously.
Yes.
But you bring up an important point here. I mean, the idea here is we want to be able to take risk. We want to be able to assume risk when we think we're going to get rewarded for it as in a long-term asset. We just want to be able to take risk where if things are, a two standard deviation event to the negative, we can weather that. It doesn't hurt us. It doesn't, imperil our ability to make benefit payments or to continue to operate. And that was one of the main goals of the FFP portion. Let's have our long-term growth, but let's keep it separate from our benefit payments, so we know we're viable here, we're still operating, we're still making our benefit payments, when this is going haywire. Because we know the range of outcomes here is pretty broad. There's going to be bad periods. We want to be able to weather them, not sell that, you know, real estate, stock, et cetera, when it's down. Mm-hmm. That's what hurts you. When you have to sell when it's down, then you've got the permanent impairment of capital. We want to be able to have it be down, reevaluate the market. If things are, quote unquote, in the normal range, it's just a negative normal outcome, we want to be able to come back in with fresh capital, buy at cheap asset prices, and ride it back up. That's how we do the compounding. So slide 6 kind of talks about the performance impact, and I think that maybe that's the other slide I really want the trustees to focus on here. One is that, we have that narrower range of outcomes. Two, this is we had the conversation in November, what does each sub-portfolio do? And I understand it gets way too technical at times. We're trying to, make that a little bit more simplified. But here, from a very, very simplistic manner, what should each sub-portfolio do and what should it roll up in the total fund? Liquidity, like we said, about a quarter of the portfolio. Store and disperse benefit payments. From a functional standpoint, real simple. Performance impact, it's going to reduce the total fund return in rising markets. There's no doubt about that, rising equity markets. But maintain value in flat or falling markets there. It's our buffer. It's our anchor to windward. It's our operating capital, for lack of a better term. Growth, we try to keep a big allocation to growth because we still want that long-term rate of return. So, John, to your point, how do we get back to a 7% or a 6.5% or whatever the market's offering us? How do we get at least our fair share of what the market's offering us in terms of long-term growth? Well, we try to keep as much into that growth allocation as possible. And this is when the equity market's up, this one's going to do well. When the equity market's down, when global growth is down, this is going to do poorly relative to other asset segments here. But this is, this will be our headline risk driver. It always will be. We never take that out. We just want to be able to weather the ups and the downs there. And the risk diversifying, like we talked about earlier, really should have a somewhat neutral impact on total fund returns, but with the ability to do the rebalancing. So to be able to be the beneficiaries of market volatility, not to suffer during market volatility. If we can rebalance, if we can buy cheap stocks on dips and compound that over decades, that's what separates us from peers who don't have that flexibility. I think one of the other questions that came out in November was, can we have something on the website that briefly explains what this is? So, there's some place that you all can refer to, that the public can refer to, that beneficiaries can refer to. And our thought would be to build something akin to this table here. And Jeff, can you hand out the takeaways there? And we have a one-pager for the trustees, just a reference document more than anything else. But the thought would be to take this reference document and build something off this to use on our website. We're going to obviously go through a long conversation about what's appropriate to be in the public domain, so there's enough information and not too much information, but it would be something that kind of looks like this. And really the takeaway there is that last piece, total fund, again, rise less in rising equity markets, fall less in falling markets, win by not losing. That's really the main goal of FFP, and it should be the snapshot, the elevator pitch. You divide it up, we're protected, we can assume risk, and we should win by not losing. Slide 7 kind of talks about that distribution of each sub-portfolio and how it rolls up to the total. This one we had in the November meeting as well, but just a reminder that we want to take our risks where we're compensated for doing so. So the growth allocation is going to be big. Liquidity, we know we're not going to have a high rate of return, at least in today's yield environment, on the liquidity portfolio, and the risk diversifying being the offset. And so when we roll it all up in the total fund, our goal is really to be in that northwest quadrant. We want to have a lower risk profile and be on the higher return side. If we can compound slowly and methodically over time, that's where we expect to get to there. And slide 8 talks about metrics of success. This is a reminder of what we talked about in November. This will be the staff reports that come out about each sub-portfolio. And again, I understand that there's a lot of technicalities here. There's a lot of detail here. We're going to have a high-level, simple explanation for most of this, but the details will be there. We do intend to roll this out beginning with the first quarter report. And that'll be a staff report that supplements, doesn't replace, supplements the Verus report. So Verus will give you the overview of the world, and we'll talk about how it dials into each one of our sub-portfolios. And then I just want to give a little bit of guidance on slide 9 about what you should expect in the upcoming year. From an operations perspective, to fully implement FFP, we've got a couple more pieces to put in place. So we're going to have additional commitments to private equity. We're underwriting 3 funds right now. Expect those to be coming back to the trustees in the first to second quarter at this point. Private credit, StepStone is up and running with private credit, and we'll give an update once they've got the first 3 pieces in place. And we're going to have new allocations to private real estate. So that is going to be, you know, operating in the background there to get up to and maintain target allocations there. I think the big piece for completion of FFP is getting the risk diversifying built out. We've got placeholders there right now with AFL-CIO with the Treasury exposure, and Wellington with their inflation hedging portfolio. We are looking to bring one new manager back to the trustees at the second February meeting, and we'll probably hopefully be able to supplement that with 1 to 2 more over the remainder of the year. So that allocation will get built up, and we'll have additional conversations with the trustees about that quite soon, actually. And as we build out those pieces, the other thing you should expect to see is that ongoing reduction in the domestic equity allocation down to its target, down to closer to its target allocation. It's got a target allocation of 6%, which is a dramatic departure from our history, as we've talked about in the past, but it takes a lot of time to get drawn down. So expect to see that happen. From an investment perspective, again, we had a really strong equity market year last year. And we have a lower equity allocation than our peers. So if you're looking at pure relative results or just an absolute sense about where to benchmark this, it's going to be positive, but on the lower side. We take a look at the initial estimates, and we are above the 7% for 2017, certainly, but you're going to see funds that did better than us if they had a larger equity allocation. If the equity markets flatten or decline, we should expect to maintain our positive results, and hopefully on an absolute basis, certainly on a relative basis, have some outperformance there.
So long-term growth, you're aiming for 6%. We're somewhere around 16, between 16 and 17% right now. What are you looking at in terms of going down to 6%?
In terms of the timeline?
Yeah. No, not timeline. Who?
Oh, which managers?
Yes.
I think largely the asset allocation maintains a weight to U.S. large cap and not to U.S. small cap. So, and this is not news to any of our managers. They've been told that this will be an ongoing process. The small cap managers will get drawn down. The active equity managers in large cap space will get drawn down. And that'll happen over the next 3 years, but beginning over the next few months here.
And you'll keep us abreast of that?
I absolutely will.
Before you do it or after?
If it's a rebalancing, we'll notify you. If there's a termination, we'll be in front of the trustees with a memo before it happens.
In the rising rate environment, mm-hmm. Is it accurate that the liquidity portfolio would do better? But is it also the case that because of that, the movement of money into shorter term instruments with enhanced returns pulls some driver away from either the growth portfolio or somewhere else? In other words, does the incremental rise in rates that we're seeing now, mm-hmm. which is going to benefit the liquidity side, right? Does that drag away on the growth side? In other words, take away some of the fuel that's driving that engine, or no?
In terms of, you're talking about the underlying economic drivers, or are you talking about the actual asset allocation?
I'm talking about the drivers.
Yeah. Certainly, if we see rates, it kind of depends on the reason for rate rise. If the rates are rising as a result of an inflationary environment, we could see some hit to the to the stock markets. I mean, the stock markets do tend to pass through inflation, but over a longer period of time. So they have a short-term hit. They tend to recover over a longer period of time. If rates are rising based upon macroeconomic fears of growth slowdown and that sort of thing, then certainly if the fear is passing through and the rates are rising because of fear, we should expect less to be available in terms of long-term growth or in certain terms of short-term growth from the equity markets.
I was actually thinking of just the programmatic rate adjustment. In other words, okay, the Fed's committed to a program, right, that by design it looks like it wants to keep incrementally raising rates. Right?
Yep.
And does that have an effect? That's really, I'm thinking less about the natural forces and more about the planned forces.
Yeah, so Verus had a view on the Fed unwinding of QE, correct? Yeah, do you want to just highlight that?
Yeah, so I think it was in our last quarterly investment landscape, we talked a little bit about the two components that the Fed is working with, raising rates and drawing down, unwinding that quantitative easing.
Right.
They've committed to a program for unwinding the quantitative easing month by month by X dollars, and that's progressing nicely while they're trying to raise rates. And they've said that if and when we see an economic recession happen, we'll move rates first and continue with unwinding quantitative easing until rates get to zero, and then we would stop the quantitative easing unwind. So they put that plan in place, which is good. Right now, we're watching the Fed because we're seeing a changing of the guard in terms of Yellen to Powell, which is expected to be very muted. Powell has always voted with Yellen and the group and consensus in general. So we anticipate another dovish chair of the Fed, which is now raising a concern that the Fed will be behind the curve as inflation starts to peak its ugly head. So now as we see wages starting to increase marginally in the Europe labor statistics data, and then we're getting the anecdotal evidence that J.P. Morgan is raising employee salaries and Southwest and other airlines are paying out bonuses and such, that this anecdotal data evidence will start to filter into the economy as well, that we could actually start to see wage inflation with a dovish chair and a dovish Fed. They might be slow to react. Put that all together, you have an equity market that says, hooray, and watch the stocks continue to go up. So the market is embracing that maybe too much. So we might want to start wondering if the market's getting ahead of itself in that respect, and that the Fed should actually raise rates.
Aren't the Southwest announcement, that there have been several from large employers based on the tax relief. To me, that struck me as kind of one-time money. Those were like employee bonuses or, hey, this is all going to be great before you get your layoff notice in March. It just struck me that it was episodic, right? It wasn't like a structured increase into the system that really has the effect of raising wages over time. At least that was my reaction to it.
Some are, some aren't.
So I can say it's both.
Yes, and there are pay increases going on. Mm-hmm. Yep. So it's some of both. And to your point, though, I think, Kimberly Clark announced laying off 5,000 this morning. Procter & Gamble saying prices down across the board. So, yeah, it's not going to be without, variations on the thing.
Right.
Okay. And it strikes me that if you see more Apple stories about investments, repatriating money from overseas and investing it, that's not just... I don't see it, the Apple announcement and whatnot, as being simply one-time investments. We're talking about some major commitments, and it looks as if there's a lot of capital that may be moving that direction that would be more long-term than your instant sugar fix, your $1,000 increase.
Yeah, but that kind of capital movement and investment then depends upon the trickle-down kind of philosophy, right? You have to believe that kind of... surge into the economy would necessarily tangibly wind down and ultimately result in wage growth. I don't know if I buy it. History would suggest otherwise, but I don't know. I mean, this is pretty large repatriation.
I suspect you're going to see a lot more of it, but that's just one person's guess.
Well, a tax on foreign earnings that is part of the tax bill, I think, almost mandates it. In other words, you can't leave your foreign earnings somewhere else and not be taxed on it. You will now be taxed on it. So you may as well bring it back.
Oh, right, yeah.
That's right. So that's permanent. And that clearly has an impact.
Well, I mean, to me, the thing, so Apple, Amazon, we're going to have a second or third headquarters. You see the natural effect of you can see construction activity, you can see jobs associated with that. I get all that. I just don't know if ultimately that's what drives sustained wage growth across the spectrum.
Well,
have no idea. I was just trying to figure out from the standpoint of the structure and the reference guide, that does the beauty of a rising short-term market, which enhances your liquidity, end up dragging on the back end? That's really what I was trying
to say. Okay, so the takeaway I'd like trustees to take from that type of conversation is we don't know what's going to happen from year to year. We try to take a long-term view. We do annual adjustments based upon new information. The stock markets move, the tax bills come through, we have new information, it changes our forward-looking expectations. So within our growth allocation, we might tilt in one direction or another from year to year. We have an annual refresh. It takes into account new information. The stock market's up 20%. Gee, the next decade might not be that great. Maybe we want to take some chips off the table. Tax reform comes through. Gee, maybe there'll be more spending. Maybe we want to lean into that. We get to have that conversation every year without completely changing our asset allocation. We do the tweaks. We do the leans, lean ins, lean outs there.
When is the annual refresh, by the way? When are you doing it?
So the we take a look at the asset allocation in March. We do the annual capital movements. The big capital movements happen in July because that's been when we've had the employer prepayments. That may change over time. Employer prepayments are not necessarily set in stone, but we try to do the actual physical moves when we have large cash infusions to minimize transaction costs.
So is the 12% area for risk diversification really, is that our sort of powder fund? Is that where we can lean in 12% or lean out? In other words, is that where our ability to take advantage, to be opportunistic is?
Well, we have two things there. One, every year we take a look at, within our growth, diversifying and liquidity, do we want to shift targets? Do we want to lean into emerging markets or lean out? Those would be the small lean-ins, lean-outs. That's what happens in a normal market environment. We take a look at all new information. Does this change our view? Do we want to, tweak things? When something exogenous happens, when there's a market impact, when there's a geopolitical event or, God forbid, another mortgage crisis, or, it's going to be some new crisis that we didn't see coming, then we can take money from risk diversifying and go back into the stock market with that. If that fails, or if the stock market dislocation is so big, you always have the option as a board of saying, we want to take a little bit of money out of the liquidity program and come back in here. So we have three levels there. One, our annual refresh of all our targets. Two, in a market dislocation, the movement from the risk diversifying back into growth assets to buy them cheap. We do believe in mean reversion. We do believe in, long-term, the growth markets will deliver. And three, in a really big dislocation, the board can take some chips off the table in the liquidity program and come into the stock market there. You can imagine that's a big, scary conversation at that point. That's why it's a board decision. But the normal year-to-year operations, lean in, lean out, the medium-term dislocations, risk diversifying to growth.
I could imagine if equities tank that much to have the discussion about getting into that market with additional capital. It's probably going to be a pretty harrowing circumstance.
It'd be a pretty harrowing circumstance, but we just lived through it nine and a half years ago.
Agreed. Matt?
And also, when you're thinking about timing as well, next year we do have an experience study in 19 coming up. So we'll be revisiting all of this in relation to what it looks like on the actuarial side.
So two takeaways. One, we allocate risk where we're getting paid for it. And two, we expect that to roll up to a smoother return pattern than our peers.
Actually, one question.
Win by not losing.
Cool. I really like the FFP and the concept, and I think it does presume a certain level of trustee backing. All your measures of performance are very long-term, and kind of success by not losing implies a kind of a multi-year, maybe even a multi-decade time horizon for real evaluation. given that kind of a trustee tenure is likely to be shorter than that, and perhaps staff tenure, what are the kind of ways trustees should evaluate investment staff performance?
Yeah, I think the time horizon differs by sub-portfolio, right? The liquidity portfolio, we're measuring every month. That one, it's got to generate the cash flow every month, month in, month out, and the trustees see that report. So that one's, I think, much more nuanced there. The risk diversifying is probably the medium-term one, and we want to talk about costs associated with that, what rate of return are we getting there, what correlation are we seeing with the stock market. Jay, to your point, on the illiquid asset classes, where we're talking about a decade plus for them to come to full fruition there. It is, by its very nature, the most difficult conversation we're going to have because there is the dislocation between tenure of individuals and tenure of the investments. And if we take a look at the growth allocation, really the FFP structure is allowed or is intended to offer a shorter-term buffer with liquidity program so that we can take advantage of longer-term growth allocations. How do you get around the fact that we don't know how they perform for a decade? We try to have as many early warning indicators as possible. We try to structure this in terms of the private credit in something that's more cash flow generative, so we have returns along the way rather than locking up capital for a decade before we can sell something and know what it looks like there. But there's always going to be an element of that where this is truly intended to be intergenerational capital. There are growth assets that we know won't mature for 25 years, but on average it's going to mature in the 5 to 7 year range, which I think is a pretty manageable term there. But it'd be an ongoing conversation. I think as we roll out the staff reporting in the first quarter, there's going to be some additional measures of how we're doing in the growth piece. And I think it's one of the saving graces of the growth allocation's longer term nature is the growth allocation going forward looks most similar to what we've had historically. So that's we do have a longer track record there. There's a data set we can look to there. There are managers that have been in place for a number of years there. We can take a look at long-term patterns. But I think this is going to be an iterative process where we're going to be coming back to the trustees with a lot of new measures, a lot of new thoughts around this. But there's no getting around the fact that that's the portfolio that demands the most patience in order to get the returns out of it. It's the one where we want to be able to ride the market volatility and not be forced sellers.
Tim, as a curiosity question, of our 60% in round figures in growth, what percent or what portion of that do you think is public? That is, there's a value determined every day that on an independent market, and what percent is based on the best judgment of the developers?
Ballpark, it's about half and half at target allocations. Today, it's more biased in the public markets because we haven't fully deployed, or we're just beginning to deploy our private credit, and we haven't deployed all of our private equity there. But according to the target allocations that the board adopted, it's just over half of the growth allocation is intended to be in private markets. But of course, that's going to be staggered. I mean, it's not we're going to go a decade with no updates. We're staggering this. We've got a mature private equity program that's sending a lot of money back our way these days. We have a mature real estate program that's sending a lot of money back our way these days as well.
No, I don't find any fault with what we have. It's just that you are dealing with a world that's not quite as precise either way as that pendulum really starts moving.
Oh, absolutely. And we're making our best guess about more than a guess. I mean, we're making our best informed decision about capital that we deploy today. If we take a look over the next decade, where do we expect to be most rewarded for that? And we've got a diversified basket, but it's tilting in that private markets direction. There's no doubt about that. We could certainly see an environment like 2010, 2011, where we'd have a much lower private allocation because there's much better value on offer in the public markets. And the annual refresh is intended to say, every year we take a look at where we're at, where do we want to deploy each marginal dollar? And have that conversation on an ongoing basis. So Jay, to your point there, there's an annual refresh. There's an annual conversation about that. And the fact that we have some mature programs, I think there's a lot of data embedded in the real estate and private equity. The private credit is going to be more difficult because we're going to be taking that from close to zero to something large. But because that's a much shorter tenured asset class, I think we're going to see certainly be able to track cash flows, yields on that. There's going to be quite a bit of information coming through that program, much more so than on the private equity side. So I think that'll be an interesting conversation for the trustees. As we get like a year into the private credit program, we're going to start to have some good data there. And we have good data on the other privates today.
And Jay, also, I think part of it has to do with institutional knowledge and the documentation of that information.
Yeah.
And I think that when it comes to investments, I think it's important to have a layered approach, that we have solid, you know, not only procedures but processes, and you know, when it comes to sourcing information, how we go through it, you know, how that, you know, layers up to reporting and communicating to the board, and making sure that we have a solid foundation there, so that if there are transitions in certain areas, that the plan and the board is able to weather those things.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. So much of it really depends on kind of trustee commitment, and there are periods of time where the FFP could underperform for whatever reason, whether it's high inflation or some kind of exogenous factor, and I'm sure at the beginning everyone's going to be, you know, okay with maybe some shorter period of underperformance, but perhaps there's a point where, you know, people's patience gets tested, and kind of that commitment gets tested. Mm-hmm. 3 or 4 years into the liquidity portfolio or whatever, yeah. And that's entirely within the kind of that normal set of probabilities. And for this whole thing to work, you really have to have people kind of buy in and stay in. And I think part of it is setting the expectations that that could actually happen. And if that does happen, you can't panic. And part of that is, you know, you setting some expectations of reasonableness, right? So when things like that do happen, people aren't freaking out and saying, oh, that's normal, I didn't expect that to happen, I was reading the newspaper and that shouldn't have happened. You know, it's just getting kind of expectations on board with possibilities.
Yep. Point taken. And I think
to your point, a trustee being aware of how the fund is doing. One of the things early on when I became a trustee years ago was the Coons report that comes out, and you're probably familiar with that. And I always used to look at that and say, hey, we're doing this or we're doing that. And in years past, we've always been in like the top quartile. Even in the bad year. Yeah, really high. But with this new FFP, I know I'm going to look at it next year, and we're not going to be, well, even this year it showed up for the first time that we weren't in the top quartile in certain areas of that report. And you just have to, in my head, I had to say to myself, look, that's you know what's going on, yep. You know what's happening. But it's still discouraging, because I like being number one. I always like being number one. But it wasn't happening in certain areas. But I look at this, and I know this is long-term. For me, there's the guarantee that retirees are going to get their check even in a downturn. To your point, that's where I was with as a trustee, where I was going, and my whole mindset is having to change with the FFP, and you know I'm grasping it, and I'm accepting of it. I voted for it, so you know I just got to ride it out, good and bad, you know. And in the long term, this may be very successful, but again, I will have moments when I'll look at that Coons report and go, oh man.
Well, and there's a great point there, because I think one of the things that's going to be helpful for the trustees, and certainly been helpful for my staff, when we roll out the staff reports, one of our major benchmarks for each sub-portfolio and each manager is we write out a thesis. Why did we hire this manager? Why do we have this sub-portfolio? And, you know, in addition to market benchmarks and liquidity profiles and risk profiles, simply stating, like, we hired this manager to provide long-term growth with you know, a high degree of volatility, but we want to be able to rebalance around them. Okay, great. We know why they're there. That's going to go into the trustees' reports as well. So even if there's a question about a sub-portfolio or an individual manager, there's a statement there that accompanies that. Why did we hire them? If we're not meeting that thesis, well, there's a great conversation about, you know, does that manager belong in our program? And at the same time, when we have a manager who invariably has a poor period, it's like, did they violate their thesis? Or was this a poor period for the asset segment that they invested in? And I think, you know, getting to that finely tuned nature of this, what does each manager, what does each sub-portfolio do for Contra Costa? What does it further for our goals? It's really more that finely tuned nature of this rather than saying, where do we rank versus people who are geographically nearby to us? That doesn't necessarily pay our bills.
On the latter point, in response to what Jay said, I think the anxiety level or the getting happy feet about a particular investment or a manager is a different discussion when the result or the return from that particular manager isn't necessary to pay the bills. If I understand anything about what we've done with this, it's that the structure in creating the liquidity portfolio takes the anxiety out of the longer term investment, the growth investments, to meet the obligations, puts it into the liquidity category so that we know we make the $35 million a month nut or whatever it turns out to be. Mm-hmm. So that there's a more thoughtful, at least I'd like to think, that there's a more thoughtful discussion about a manager performance, because everybody who comes onto this board, and I was certainly no exception, you have to be educated about the J curve, you have to find out what patience is a virtue, you have to understand that a bad quarter or two or even three doesn't make a bad manager. So it's a hell of a lot easier to have that discussion based on maybe a thesis-based discussion rather than we need the money discussion, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We need the money discussion is a very real, very tangible discussion.
Right.
And you never want to sell the manager who's down to pay a bill.
I'm sort of thinking of Jay's point. Those who've been following the market for any number of years, and I think it was prior to 2008, I remember there's a book that came out, The Dow at 36,000. And it almost was laughable at the time that
yes,
this
what?
Was absolutely pie in the sky. Here we are, with 36 no longer looking like it's an impossible number. And if it goes from the current 26 to 36, the broad community that we serve in and practice in is going to have their focus on the 36. And we've designed this to trail that, design a portfolio to not do as well as other portfolios in periods of high growth high net increases in public markets. Anyway, I can absolutely see that occurring, should that occur. Obviously, no one knows whether it's going to occur in any near term.
Yeah.
But
no, I mean, if the Dow goes to 36, it's you know, we're going to be returning 12s and 15s, and our peers might be returning 18s and 20s, and that's not going to feel great for you know, trustee sitting in your seats there.
With
the same point, the Dow goes to 16. I want to live to fight another day.
Yeah.
Did you have something, Will?
Yeah, I just I was on this board when we talked about this and we evaluated this, and this seemed like the best model to go after in terms of asset allocation. I mean, it was like an LDI or a liability-driven kind of what I consider a LDI kind of hybrid, where you're basically sheltering money for your benefit payments in a secure cash position, but then you're taking the opportunity, so you're kind of taking that, and by the end of the model, you're reducing your risk and volatility and also increasing your return.
Which was so surprising.
I mean, from that standpoint, but going forward, Jay, to your point about, you know, the tenure of the board, there's 12 of us on this board. You know, we're all not going to leave next week in one time. There's institutional knowledge that's also passed on from trustee to successor, you know, predecessor to successor, and understanding things like this. So I see this. I honestly, I mean, we're in a three-year transition for FFP. Mm-hmm. So 3 years before it's even fully implemented, or thereabout, mm-hmm. before we even start to really see the true effects of what it's going to do. And I honestly don't think it can be evaluated until we've had a complete downturn with a recovery. I mean, honestly, to really see what the effects is, and that's years. I mean, so if 2008 happens tomorrow, we're looking at 10 years to fully evaluate it, right? And I think along those lines, we can look at the Coons report, we can look at our funding ratio, we can look at the individual performance of the managers, and we can also look at things that happen to our other peers, which is what happens to them in the downturn. You know, per the model, we should be, you know, have a less of a loss. So I think there's a lot of things, you know, along the ways. I find it to be very innovative. I think it's the first in the space, if you will, of this type of model. And one of the questions I have is, I know we're talking about putting it possibly on the website in terms of publication. Two questions. One is, have there been any papers or any things written about it in the space, either from our consultants or you, or is that appropriate? Or has there been criticism? You know, has there been anything written about it? And has anybody else even talked about implementing something similar to this? Just out of curiosity, because there's got to be word on the street, right? There's got to be a buzz.
Yeah, there's a lot of examples of things like this. Yeah. This is the first one branded FFP in terms of functionally focused portfolio. Most of them take the approach of thinking about the liquidity component first. Mm-hmm. Designing for that, and then thinking constructively about where to invest the rest. And so then categorizing it as growth and risk diversifying are also unique here in terms of those naming conventions. But the technique has been used by foundations and endowments, by health and welfare plans, by other pension plans. Yeah, there's nothing novel about this from that perspective, the branding and the labeling. Yes. Sorry,
Tim. No. We borrowed liberally from a lot of different plans and a lot of different thought processes. And there is a white paper on our website that we wrote, staff wrote,
right,
prior to going into this that kind of outlined what the thought process was. So there's a statement there. And again, you know, I borrowed from LDI, I borrowed from endowment investing, put something together I thought was germane to Cicera and addressed trustee concerns. And to Ed's point, like, you know, is anyone else doing FFP? Well, probably not. Is anybody else doing something that walks, talks like it? Sure. Yeah. On our website, I want to make sure we're stating clearly to the world, or at least to our constituency, this is what we're doing and why, and this mm-hmm. is how you should expect it to perform.
And it would be backed with things like, you know, the board's, you know, decision to go with this was, you know, based off these findings in terms of the modeling and that type of thing? I mean, in terms of, or is that getting into?
Well, okay, so, I mean, what I heard from the trustees of November was, we want someplace to turn to for a simple snapshot explanation of this. And that's why we went down this website path here. You know, what's already available to the public? Well, the white paper is, the asset allocation reports, the quarterly performance reports, that's all there. What I was hearing from the trustees was, you know, maybe there's a even simpler like landing page that then leverages all the existing resources that are on our website.
Gotcha.
There. And we'll you know, obviously Gail and I'll talk and we'll work with the communications department to figure out something that works. But
Jerry?
Perfect segue into my thoughts on the communications, which I still think is critical. This is excellent. It does a really good job. I think it's heading in the right direction. It's not quite soup yet, at least from a communication standpoint. If I could, it's kind of like two different pyramids. There's a upside down pyramid and a right side pyramid. The upside down pyramid representing what we've accomplished and communicated. The right side up pyramid representing the journalistic pyramid. And I'm going to try and put those two points together if I could. This begs for, again, some brief narrative, English, that actually this is a terrific exhibit and a really nice job of distilling all of the stuff down. But it, for me, it just begs for some kind of a brief narrative, as brief as possible, that says, this is what we did. It's a compare and contrast. It says, this is what many other plans do, most other plans do. This is what we're doing and how it's different. And then that also would represent that top pyramid of a press release type. I'm not saying we send out a press release, but that's the way journalism typically works, is that they give you the very top level picture, which is our bottom level picture that we finally got to, and then they start expanding the details. Again, in my opinion, we should be sitting there able to say, this is how our plan strategy differs from most others, in a few sentences. And I've written a few sentences, but they're too long. They need editing. But it basically says, this is how this is different.
Yep.
And then here's an example of why, how we make different turn into soup. Yes. So again, you said working with the communication staff, I would encourage you to do that and try and make sure that everybody in the room then is able to understand exactly what we say we're doing, and then give all these examples as to how we got there.
Great.
And what we're doing.
You were serious today.
Sorry?
You were serious today. And you got a pyramid metaphor with soup.
Right.
Soup and mixed metaphors. It's, I do it a lot.
So let's focus on why we're different versus...
But I'm tired of rowing upstream with this group.
Oh, listen.
Anything else for Tim?
Why focus?
Roars out, you'll be okay.
Why focus on why we're different versus more of an explanation of what we're trying to achieve and how we're trying to do it? Is it how... Is anyone going to really recognize that we're that much different than other plans, and do we have to go...
I don't think we have to go into great detail, but it's just for me, it's a compare and contrast. It sort of says, this is what Cesera has done in the past. This is what many other plans continue to do. We're not knocking what we did in the past or knocking what they're doing, but this is how this is a different approach to accomplishing the same thing.
Well, and I'd say what we almost need, and with this, I think you're talking about a little narrative, it's the elevator speech to explain to people why we didn't hit 15% return on investments. Because that's going to be the first, we're the trustees, all of the beneficiaries are going to say, what's wrong with you idiots? Yeah. You know, the market's skyrocketing and you're just sitting there doing some new plan and we're not reaping the benefit of this, you know, huge increase
equity
in the stock
market.
So I think that's sort of what, as trustees, we need the simple, and on the website, the simple explanation, the elevator speech, whatever you want to call it, of this is why we're different, this is what we're doing to ensure the stability of the plan. I also do really like the graph that you had back on slide six, is it six? Yeah, four, on slide four. Even having that, you know, on the website too, just saying we're trying to narrow, yes, we're not going to get the highs, but we're not going to have extreme lows. And that may well be the elevator speech or part of it. So,
Then you have to have a piece there then that discusses volatility and how that can actually hurt returns.
There's a lot of great input here. I think we'll take this and we'll work internally on what makes sense for the website and clean
see you
it up
next
here.
Meeting, right?
Next meeting.
Thank you,
You're
Tim.
Getting there.
Really good, Tim. This is good stuff.
Very, thanks, very Tim. Well done.
Thanks, Tim.
Okay.